Well, welcome, everybody. This is Joan Chevry. I'm one of the policy specialists here at EDUCAUSE, and I want to thank you for joining today's briefing on the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, or ECPA, reform and its implications for higher education. First, I want to give you a few notes about today's briefing. This briefing will be recorded. It is being recorded now. The audio recording and the chat transcript will be available to participants of the discussion later today. If you'd like to request a copy, please email Valerie Vogel at vvogel@educause.edu. Audio is only available using our phone conference line today. You will not be able to hear this through the Adobe Connect meeting room. So please note that the participant lines will be muted, so all of the questions for our speaker should be entered in via the Adobe Connect chat, and then I will relay them to the speaker. So it's important that you get into Adobe Connect if you wish to ask a question. Our guest speaker today is Greg Nogheim, who is a senior counsel and director of the Project on Freedom, Security, and Technology at the Center for Democracy and Technology, which is a Washington, D.C. nonprofit public policy organization dedicated to keeping the Internet open, innovative, and free. Greg specializes in protecting privacy in the digital age against intrusion by the U.S. government and is a recognized expert on the application of the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution of electronic surveillance in the national security, intelligence, and criminal arenas. He spearheaded CDT's efforts to promote judicial supervision of surveillance of Americans' private telephone and email conversations in connection with legislation to update the U.S. Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, in 2008. He is currently a leader in CDT's cybersecurity work, testifying in both the House and the Senate on the impact of cybersecurity proposals on privacy, civil liberties, and technology innovation. He is the author of Cybersecurity and Freedom on the Internet, which was published in the Journal of National Security Law and Policy. Greg is also deeply involved in a multi-year, broad-based project to update the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, or ECPA, about which he will speak to us today. As co-chair of the Coordinating Committee on National Security and Civil Liberties of the American Bar Association's section on individual rights and responsibilities, Greg was one of the lead drafters of ABA's 2007 policy on the state secrets privilege. Prior to joining CDT in May of 2007, Greg was the associate director and chief legislative counsel of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office. He graduated from the University of Rochester with a BA in political science, and he received his JD from the University of Virginia. So welcome, Greg, especially having you, it's great to have you here today, especially to talk about ECPA, during which is Data Privacy Month, which will be ending at the end of January. So please, we're all ready for you, and we'd love to hear you, what you have to tell us.
Thanks so much, Joan. I really, really appreciate the opportunity of to be here. As Joan said, I work at the Center for Democracy and Technology, and we are involved in an effort to update the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. I welcome this opportunity to talk to you because I became concerned as we were moving through the process to update the law that students' rights could be adversely affected. And so I'll get into that a little bit later. During our call, it's something that is avoidable, but it's going to require some activism and some contact with Congress, and I'll be talking about ways to do that also. But first, let me back up a little bit and explain to you what ECPA is, where it came from, and then get into the effort to reform the law. ECPA, at its root, ECPA comes from the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment provides that the right of people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. That probably was hard to interpret in 1791 when it was drafted or adopted. But today, in the digital world, it's almost impossible to understand exactly what the Fourth Amendment covers and doesn't cover. What are a person's papers and effects? Does that include email? Does it include email held by a third party, like a university or like Google? What kind of warrant, if there is one, particularly describes an email message or other communication to be seized? So while the Fourth Amendment provides good, strong privacy protections, and courts have interpreted it as over time, nobody was sure in 1984, 85, and 86, as internet communications became more and more common, how the Fourth Amendment would apply, particularly to the information that people stored with service providers. So to resolve some of the uncertainty, Congress enacted the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. Email, cell phone use, and large-scale data processing were just beginning, and the purpose of the law was to fill the gaps where Fourth Amendment protection was uncertain. There was this one case, Smith v. Maryland, where the court decided that numbers dialed on a telephone were unprotected by the Fourth Amendment, even though the conversation that you had on the telephone was. And the theory was that the numbers dialed were being held by a third party, the phone company, and that they weren't particularly revealing. So nobody knew how Smith v. Maryland, that Supreme Court case, would apply to the internet, so Congress stepped in with a statute. And the statute, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, has two parts. The Wiretap Act, which governs real-time access to the contents of electronic communications, and the Stored Communications Act, which specifically covers stored records and communications. It also includes the Pen Register and Trap and Trace Statute, which governs access in real time to non-content information, such as who you emailed and who emailed you, and who you phoned and who phoned you. The SCA, the Stored Communications Act, again, which is part of ECPA, applies only to a provider of electronic communications service to the public and a provider of remote computing service to the public. What's an electronic communications service? It's any service which provides users the ability to send or receive wire or electronic communications. Universities that provide their students with the ability to connect to the internet and to send communications and receive them fit within the definition of electronic communications service providers. ECPA also covers remote computing services. Those are services that involve the provision to the public of computer storage or processing services by means of an electronic communication system. I've always thought the best example of an RCS is a service like Google Docs. If you store a document at Google Docs and then come back to edit it later and you don't share it with other people, Google Docs is acting as a remote computing service, and that document is under the Stored Communications Act and protected by ECPA. Query though, what a university is, does it offer a storage service like that to the public maybe some do, maybe some don't, because if the service is not offered to the public, the entity is not acting as a remote computing service, because to the public is built into the definition. I think it's fair to say, though, that many entities, including many universities, offer both electronic communication services and remote computing services. And it's important to distinguish what service is being offered when law enforcement comes and seeks data being held by the use of that service, because different rules apply. And the short form is that electronic communication services trigger the warrant requirement and remote computing services don't. I'll pause just a second for questions. Are there any questions that we need to address at this moment?
Yes, Greg. One of the participants has asked, does the application of ECPR pertain to only data stored in the U.S., or can it be applied to U.S. companies storing data in other countries?
Oh, that's a very good question. The rules, the international data rules, are not yet set in stone. What I do think it's fair to say, though, is that the way they've been working out of late is that the U.S. court, before which the government would drag the U.S. company to compel the disclosure of user data, will tell the company, you must disclose this information, if process is proper, no matter where it is stored. And a lot of other countries have adopted the same rule. It's called the Bank of Nova Scotia rule. Now, what happens, though, if the rules in the country where the data is physically stored prohibit disclosure pursuant to the rule that the U.S. court is acting under? What happens then? We did a convening at CDT, and we brought a bunch of companies together to discuss that. And the bottom line is that nobody was sure, and that the way it got resolved was usually through a negotiation between the company and the courts and the parties. So it was, I think it's fair to say that the rules aren't yet clear, but that so far companies have been muddling along, particularly when they are caught between two conflicting legal regimes. If the legal regimes don't conflict, then the U.S. company would respond to the mandatory process that the U.S. court would use to compel the disclosure. Moving on,
yeah, that would be good, Greg. I think you can go on, especially I think as before you paused for questions, you started talking about some of the differences in ECPA and how it again would apply to higher ed, and I think that's something that our participants as well as myself would be interested in hearing more about.
So I talked about one distinction, and that was the kind of service being offered. Was it a remote computing service, or was it an electronic communication service? And a good way to think of how to distinguish those two is that a remote computing service involves the computer storage and processing. You're holding a document. You're processing data. It's not being communicated between two third parties. And once it's being communicated between two third parties, once the communication goes from one person to another person through a provider, that provider is acting as a ECS, an electronic communication service. So what information is covered by by ECPA? There are basically three types of data, and different rules apply to different types of data. There's the contents of communications, there's records about communications, and then there are what we call subscriber identifying information. And the subscriber identifying information is protected at the lowest level. That's data like who belongs to this email address? What's their name? Where do they live? How do they pay for their service? That is classic subscriber identifying information. Oh, and also who had this IP address on this day at this time? That's another example of subscriber information. That data is available to law enforcement on a mandatory basis when it uses a subpoena. Contents, on the other hand, are protected at a higher level when the content is not old. If the content is less than 6 months old, then law enforcement needs a warrant, which can only be issued on a showing of probable cause, a relatively high standard, in order for law enforcement to gain access to it. It would have to be, they would have to go in front of a judge, show a lot of facts that establish that a crime is being committed and that the contents of the communication stored with the particular provider are relevant to that crime. So it's a fairly high showing for communications held by an electronic communications service provider in electronic storage. Now, the in electronic storage qualification turns out to be important. In electronic storage doesn't mean held electronically, like it sounds. Instead, it's two particular kinds of electronic storage only. It's got to be temporary, intermediate storage incidental to transmission, and it's got to be storage by an electronic storage by an electronic communication service for purpose of backup protection of the communication. That sounds kind of strange, but I believe the reason Congress did that was to distinguish the records being held by this electronic communication service provider on behalf of its users, people who are communicating through it, from the records that it's holding as an entity itself, from its own corporate records. So what the Department of Justice did, though, was it interpreted this language, the definition of electronic storage, to mean that email, once it's opened, is no longer protected by the warrant requirement. And that becomes particularly important because what email do you open? You open the email that's important. What email don't you open? You don't open junk mail. You don't open spam. So under this reading of the statute, the only thing that's protected is junk mail because by the warrant requirement, because everything else becomes an opened email. That was one of the things that we saw early on needed to be fixed. And so reform proposals fix this problem by ensuring that email is protected, whether it's in electronic storage or is otherwise held, stored, or maintained by the provider. I've mentioned two of the three types of information that are covered by the electronic communications Privacy Act. One was content. One was subscriber information. The third type of information are all other records, and they are mostly transactional records. Who emailed who? Who telephoned who? What are the URLs of the websites that this person has visited? Those records are covered under the Stored Communications, under the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, by an intermediate level of review. For subscriber information, law enforcement only needs a subpoena. For contents, law enforcement needs full probable cause. For these records in the middle, the log of who you emailed and who emailed you, there's a medium level of protection. And that medium level is that there have to be specific and articulable facts that the information sought is relevant and material to a law enforcement investigation. So again, three types of data and three different standards for it.
Greg, can I interrupt just for a second to ask for clarification? I believe I heard you say that on the contents, that it would be, it was subject to a higher standard for less than 6 months for a warrant. What happens if it's more than 6 months?
If it's more than 6 months, the information is protected only by a subpoena requirement. That means it drops all the way down from full probable cause to the lowest level of protection. And that seems counterintuitive because often the most important email that you receive is that which you save the longest. Why would it be at a lower level of protection? The answer is because when ECPA was adopted in 1986, providers didn't store email for people for a long time. The typical model was you would access the email from the provider's website. You download it to your computer, and then you would use it or respond to the email. And the providers, they didn't hold on to communications for a long time because storage was expensive. Fast forward to today, storage is cheap. And you've got providers saying things like, why would you ever delete a message? And you've got users accessing communications stored with their providers from remote locations. You don't have to do it from your home computer anymore. You can access it anywhere. So technology changed, and as a result, more and more information that used to be protected by the warrant standard is now only protected by a subpoena standard. That was one of the things that we wanted to fix and that we are working on fixing. So,
that's a great clarification. Thank you. And it's interesting to see how things have changed over time. We've also received another question asking for a clarification so that a non-shared Google Doc is an RCS, but a shared Google Doc is an electronic communication. Is that correct?
I think that is correct, and I think it has not yet been settled. But it makes sense to look at the sharing like the sending of a communication, an email, from one person to another. So long as you're controlling the universe of people who have access to the shared document, I believe that the shared document becomes an electronic communication as opposed to a document held through a remote computing service. And again, why is that important? Because the standard for RCS storage, remote computing service, is only a subpoena, but the standard for an electronic communication service is a warrant. Now, I was talking with a representative of one company, and she said, listen, look at how hard it is to apply the rules that govern content for a company that that say is like Google and is storing documents for its users. If it's true that the communication of the document, the allowing other people to see and edit the document, turns it into an electronic communication, how do you apply the 180-day rule? When does the clock start ticking? Does it start ticking when the person first stored the document? Does the clock reset when a new person is given access to the document? Does the 180-day rule, how does the 180-day rule apply to an edit? Does the clock start ticking again for the whole document when that one line of it is edited, or is there a separate clock, a shot clock, for the edit only? So the 180-day rule becomes really absurd and impossible to apply in that context. So knowing this and understanding how difficult these rules were to apply and how little sense they make given the way we communicate today, we brought together a group of companies and privacy groups and academics and came up with a reform proposal to deal with this problem. And what we said was, it shouldn't matter whether the information is held by a remote computing service or an electronic communication service. First, those definitions are hard to apply to a lot of entities today. And second, the way people communicate, they expect that their information will be protected at the warrant standard, regardless of how they're communicating it. So one of the reform proposals is that content, no matter how it's held, no matter how long it's held, no matter whether the holder is a remote computing service or an electronic communication service, no matter whether the email has been accessed or not, should be protected by the warrant standard. A straight, simple, no-nonsense rule that solves a lot of the ambiguities and helps bring the law up to date.
That's helpful. Thank you. Also, before you go on, there's been another question asking. The questioner says that he's curious about the impact ECPA has on smartphones as both a means of electronic communication and storage, and any difference between personally owned and institutionally provided devices.
So, smartphones are like mini computers, but they also generate records about, in particular, a person's location. So every few minutes, your phone is communicating to a cell phone tower, and it's telling the provider, I'm here. If a call comes in for Greg, send it to Greg through this tower. And the providers save those records about where the phone was, what towers the phone was hitting off of, and they save them for different periods. It turns out that records of your location are very useful to law enforcement, and so law enforcement has sought those records from providers, both in real-time and stored versions. So where is Greg right now? What tower is his phone pinging off of? What towers is his phone pinging off of? That will give us more precise location. And maybe if you could please, provider, activate the GPS chip in Greg's phone to give us a very precise location. When ECPA was adopted, there were almost no cell phones in use. Cell phones looked like bricks. They weighed almost as much as bricks. There were maybe a few thousand or a few tens of thousands in use. Now there are as many cell phones as there are humans in the country. And so everybody has one of these little tracking devices. But ECPA doesn't set any rule for law enforcement location information, for law enforcement access to location information. Can the phone be used to track you without a warrant? We don't know. Courts have decided this issue in different ways. Some have required warrants, some haven't. Some have said it matters whether law enforcement seeks the data from storage or in real time. Some have said that the distinction ought to be drawn between GPS location and triangulation, finding the person's precise location by triangulating between the towers the phone is hitting off of. One of our proposals was to fix all that by making it so that there was one standard for location information, a warrant standard, no matter whether it was stored or real time, no matter whether it was GPS or cell tower generated. So that's our second reform proposal. Now, as for content that's being communicated through use of a cell phone, it's treated like content being communicated through another device, like a regular computer. Law enforcement has to abide by the same ECPA rules for that information as for information that's sent from computer to computer. Does that answer the question?
I think so. I think the other piece to this does ECPA now have any distinguishing characteristics between personally owned or institutionally provided devices?
Yes, it does. And this is particularly important for universities. But let's put universities aside. I think the way to look at it is whether the information being sought is from a provider to the public or from a provider to a subgroup, okay? My organization, the Center for Democracy and Technology, it provides internet access to all of its employees. That means it's got all the emails that I send to and that I receive and send from my office email account. CDT, as a provider to a limited class, not to the public, we're not like Google. We are providing to a limited class, to our employees. We can voluntarily disclose any communications that we have, that our employees have made, because they are ours. They're on our network, and the employee has used our equipment, if you will, our network, to make these communications. That's the key distinction. I'm not sure about ownership of the phone itself, how that would affect it. But really, the big distinction is whether the communications are going over a network that is maintained by a provider to the public or not to the public. So I just gave an example about an employer versus a provider to the public, like Hotmail or Gmail. What about a university? Are they a provider to the public or not? Well, they certainly provide services to their students and to faculty and some to alumni. But that's not the public. That's a more limited class. So for purposes of those communications, just the communications that the university is facilitating among students and faculty, those are, it is acting as an ECS, not to the public. And the rules that apply are like those that apply to an employer who's servicing the employer's employees. The university can voluntarily disclose its students' email. I don't think that they want to do that, and I think they seldom do that, but that's what the rule is, because in that context, they're acting as a provider to a limited class and not to the public. For if the university is serving the public with a service, the information being communicated over that service would be under the different rules, under the more protective rules. I see the question, what about when a university uses Google as the corporate, as their corporate email provider?
Yeah.
It triggers this situation. And there's an underlying question here, and it really gets to why I wanted to talk to you and to everybody on the phone right now. If the think of the university's corporate email, its own records that are not the records of its student users. They could be the records of generated in connection with board meetings. It could be its own records about how it figured out its tax payments. The university as an entity has its own corporate records. Those are available to law enforcement in civil and criminal investigations with a mere subpoena. Well, if that's true, then, and it is true, there has to be a way to distinguish the corporate records of the university from its student user records. And the way the current law does this is through that definition of electronic storage. Because the definition of electronic storage is not going to be the thing on which coverage of the warrant requirement now turns. Remember I said earlier that under all the reform proposals, if the information is in electronic storage or is otherwise stored, held, or maintained by the provider, then the warrant requirement will apply. Well, wait a minute. What about the university's corporate records? Are we creating a new warrant requirement for that? Well, this is one of the issues that has arisen in ECPA reform that we are going to have to resolve. And one of the proposals to resolve it was to make the warrant requirement apply only to providers to the public. Whoa. What would that mean for universities and for the email that they store on behalf of students? It would no longer be protected by the warrant requirement. Because the university would not be providing electronic communication service to the public in the context of the email services it's providing to students and faculty, all of a sudden, under that interpretation, the student email would no longer be under the warrant requirement. My organization, CDT, said that was unacceptable, and Draft legislation that had this exception in it was withdrawn, and the bill proceeded without it. But the reason I'm flagging this issue is because distinguishing corporate email from user email is an ongoing issue. It will be resolved in one way or the other. And we will be looking to make sure that it isn't resolved in a way that would adversely affect the privacy rights of students. But this public, non-public distinction becomes important. As for the particular inquiry, the university that outsources its email to Google, the university is still acting as a provider of electronic communication service to its students. If it outsources its own corporate records to Google or to another company like Salesforce, it is still going to have to respond to a law enforcement subpoena for its records. Law enforcement would go to the university and subpoena the particular records it wants. The university would be obliged to respond to the subpoena by getting the records from Google. The more interesting question is, well, what if law enforcement goes to Google to get the university's outsourced documents? Will the university get notice? Will a warrant requirement apply? Should the law enforcement be going around the university to get the information from the provider? This is also an issue that's come up, and it's coming up more and more frequently. The rules that Google would have to abide by would be those set forth in the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. Under the reform proposals being made, Google wouldn't respond favorably to the law enforcement demand absent a warrant. If law enforcement wants to use and warrants typically come without notice, although there is an effort to impose a notice requirement for the warrant demand. In other words, the university would get notice of the warrant demand. So law enforcement would have two options. One, go to Google, get the records with a warrant, or two, go to the university and get the records with a subpoena. And the subpoena, again, lower standard, but automatic notice. University knows what's been demanded, and the university can go through the records itself and say this is relevant and this isn't relevant. The problem with allowing, as ECPA does now, the law enforcement to go to the third-party provider with just a subpoena is that, A, their notice is typically delayed, and, B, the provider can't do what the target can. The provider isn't going to go through the records and make determinations about relevance. They really can't. They're not going to go through the records and make determinations about what's attorney-client privileged and what aren't. They are going to go through the records and turn over anything that they think is responsive to the subpoena. So again, that's the current world when the university outsources its corporate records to a third party, and the third party is acting as a remote computing service, those records are available to law enforcement using a subpoena, and notice to the university is typically delayed. The world that we're trying to impose would require a warrant, so that there had to be a high level of proof before law enforcement could get those records from the provider. Again, in both worlds, law enforcement could go directly to the university to get the university's records with just a subpoena.
This is fascinating, Greg. I'd also just like to point out that several of our questioners are particularly interested in FERPA, which is, you know, something that on campuses is definitely key. FERPA would prohibit the disclosure of student email since the default is that it constitutes an education record. And I don't know how comfortable you are speaking about FERPA, but that certainly is a concern on campuses. And another question is asking you to do, if you could, a comparison of the protection of student data as well as applicant data as governed by FERPA versus ECPA. And you may or may not be comfortable answering those, but I wanted to put them out there since two people had asked these questions of you.
So I don't know a lot about FERPA. As I understand it, FERPA imposes a subpoena requirement. It doesn't impose a probable cause requirement. And so I would imagine that when the two statutes conflict, that the more protective one would be the one that applies, that law enforcement could compel disclosure of the newer emails, the emails less than 6 months old, only if it had a warrant, even though FERPA allows disclosure of educational records when there is a subpoena. At least that's my understanding of FERPA. And again, I'm by no means a FERPA expert. Excuse me.
I know one of the people that asked you that question is typing in thank you. So I think that clarified some things for the participants here. There's also another question. I know you have lots to say, but there's been another question. Well, there are several, but one is specific. So when you were talking about the public and the private, the question is, what about when the university provides both an open wireless hotspot for general internet use by anyone and an encrypted private wireless network that requires authentication as a university affiliate via university-issued username and password? And then a corollary to that is that many institutions also have open terminals for the local public in places like libraries. And if you could give us your thoughts on those questions, that would be helpful.
So when it is providing access to the public through a public Wi-Fi hotspot that you don't have to have credentials to sign in on, it's acting as a provider to the public.
That's one question, yeah.
And when law enforcement seeks the public's communications from the university, it needs to come with a warrant. When it's and it doesn't matter whether it's Wi-Fi or a terminal in the library, it's providing the service to the public. When it's providing the service to a limited class, not to the public, maybe it's just students, teachers, and alumni, then it is not a provider to the public, and it has to abide, and law enforcement has to abide by the, and the university has to abide by the other rules.
Okay, that's helpful. Going back, and I know you've mentioned several of the reform proposals that CDT and others are working and putting out there, and a question a little while ago before we got into some of the specifics was, what has been the reaction as you've put these proposals out there, you know, to either members of Congress or to other groups that you've put these in front of? How are they being received?
Well, I should start by saying we have a lot of education to do because a lot of people don't understand the rules today. Obviously, they're very complicated. We were able to get the warrant for content rule through the Senate Judiciary Committee at the end of last year. And it was done on a voice vote, but there were three senators who probably would have objected had there been a roll call vote. But otherwise, you know, that's a strong bipartisan vote. The reaction that we're getting from law enforcement is that the reforms will make it harder for them to do their job. Now, there is some reason for them to say that. It's harder to show probable cause than it is to show mere relevance. And we are raising the standard to probable cause for electronic communications stored with ECS and remote computing services. But on the other hand, we do offer some help to law enforcement, and that is clarity. Right now, with the law in flux, law enforcement doesn't know whether it needs a warrant or something else in order to access content and location information. If it uses something less than a warrant, it risks the information being excluded from evidence because it was seized illegally or unconstitutionally. And the consequence of that could be that a guilty person goes free. There was a decision spot on point in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in the Warshak case that found squarely that the content of electronic communications is covered by the Fourth Amendment and that normally a warrant is required to access it. Major providers, and that means that it's protected regardless of whether the email was opened or unopened, and regardless of whether it was 180 days old or more, it's protected. It was a constitutional decision, so it declared the part of ECPA that imposes the 180-day rule for older email unconstitutional. How did the providers respond to that? Well, the large ones, in a story that just came out yesterday, are insisting on warrants for email no matter its age. Facebook, Google, Yahoo, and Twitter are all saying warrants for content. I'm not sure what the other providers are saying, but that's important because it means that law enforcement know that when they go to these providers, they're going to have to go with a warrant. And probably, even if the reforms aren't adopted, unless there's a contrary Supreme Court decision, that's the direction this would all move in. So in a way, we are seeking to codify a court decision that was based on an interpretation of the Constitution, not coming up with something from whole cloth or just an adjustment to a statute. It appears that the courts are moving in this direction and that codifying that movement would make some sense. That Warshak decision, Warshak, came down in December of 2010.
Great, thank you. Moving forward, you know, if you could address, you know, how you think this might play out in this Congress, but also could you look back and compare compliance with ECPA or ECPA reform under the Bush administration versus the current Obama administrations?
So the proposals that we made came out during Obama's term. So how the Bush administration would have responded, I think, is not clear. The Obama administration hasn't yet taken a position on ECPA reform. They have commenced an interagency process involving the Department of Commerce, the Department of Justice, and the National Security Agency, which does intelligence surveillance, and probably some other entities to come up with a position, but so far they haven't. What are the chances of getting something through this year or this Congress? I think they're better than they've ever been, but it's still an uphill climb. The reason I think they're better than they've ever been is because there's just a lot more angst about applying the current rules coming from law enforcement and from the companies that have to live under them. And because there's just a growing interest in the issue as more and more things move to the cloud. I mean, just think about all the data that used to be held locally that is now being held by third parties in the cloud. That movement to the cloud, I think, is an uncertain and shaky one right now because people don't know what the rules are that apply for law enforcement access to that data. Having a good, clear warrant for content rule would facilitate the growth of that industry, and it would facilitate the efficiencies and sometimes the extra cybersecurity that comes with storing your information with a third party who is really good at it.
This is great. We're just about at the end of the time, but I see a question here that you might take as it's a kind of a good wrap-up. It said, this topic affects a number of people in various groups in our organization, the privacy office, public safety, networking, information security, and so on. Is there a summary resource or a website, white papers, et cetera, that you could recommend to help keep a fairly diverse audience apprised of some of the issues being discussed today?
Honestly, I don't know of one that I would say is the best out there. The coalition that has pushed ECPA reform has a website to which we post major developments, particularly in the press area. So, for example, the information that I just mentioned about the major providers that are requiring warrants, that's mm-hmm. posted, or it should be posted by now.
This is the Digital Due Process Coalition, is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, www.digitaldueprocess.org. And then CDT's website, www.cdt.org, has a good primer on ECPA and on ECPA reform under the Security and Surveillance tab, front page on the right. Other groups are also posting stuff all the time. In particular, one of the members of DDP, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, I think does a good job of covering current issues.
Well, this has been great. I must say the hour has absolutely flown by. I don't think we didn't get to everybody's questions, but on behalf of our participants, I'd like to thank you for joining us today and bringing us in the education community up to speed. I also want to take a moment right now to also give a big thank you to Valerie Vogel from EDUCAUSE, who has been managing all of the behind-the-scenes technology to make all of the questions come through and to make Greg and me look good while we did this. We hope that everyone celebrated Data Privacy Day yesterday and will continue to help your campus promote Data Privacy Month with resources from EDUCAUSE as well as the National Cybersecurity Alliance. Please remember to join our final Data Privacy Month webinar tomorrow, Wednesday, January 30th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, where I will be hosting Privacy Offices Around the Virtual Water Cooler with Mary Beth Lavanino, Jane Rosenthal, and Kent Wada. I want to thank all of the participants on the phone today for all of your questions and your participation. And again, Greg, I want to thank you so much for your time and efforts. It's really been helpful. I hope you all have a very good afternoon, and I'll say goodbye for now. Thank you.